selling weapons to Tel Aviv. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gitsum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Palestinians are facing an endless cycle of death and destruction as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip enters its 171st day. The latest Israeli strikes have claimed dozens of lives on the coastal territory. 22 members of the same family were killed when their home in Gaza's central city of Deir al-Bala was targeted. At least 10 people were killed in the Israeli bombing of the southern city of Rafah. Several Palestinians lost their lives in Israeli airstrikes on the Al-Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. The regime forces also besieged two hospitals in southern Gaza, apart from Al-Shifa in Gaza City. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel has informed the international body that it would no longer allow UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed more than 32,200 lives, mostly women and children, since October 7th. Earlier we spoke to our correspondent Muti Abu Musabe from the city of Deir al-Bala in central Gaza. He said Israeli warplanes keep attacking residential buildings in Gaza while the siege on Al-Shifa Hospital continues.
Let's begin from Deir al-Balah city here, where the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre against the Palestinian civilians after the Israeli warplanes destroyed several residential buildings in Al-Bia Street, located in the western part of Deir al-Balah city. In the other areas of Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces also continued their attacks and airstrikes. And in Rafah city, as you know, that several residential buildings were destroyed over the last night by the Israeli occupation warplanes. While when it comes to Khan Yunis city, particularly Al-Karara neighborhood, the Israeli occupation forces targeted that area intensely over the last night by the successive and relentless Israeli airstrikes and the artillery shelling that reached that area. While when it comes to the western part of Khan Yunis city, the Israeli occupation forces are still circumventing and attacking the Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Amal Hospital. They are located in the western part of the city. As you know, they were subjected to a brutal ground offensive over the last couple of months after the Israeli occupation forces attacked that area amid heavy gunfire and bombardment. The vast majority of the Palestinian residential buildings and houses were completely or partially destroyed. When it comes to the Al-Shifa complex, the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the buildings of the Al-Shifa medical complex. The upper roofs and the upper floors actually were targeted and hit relentlessly over the last night by the Israeli tanks that are still surrounding the buildings, knowing that hundreds of the Palestinian people are still stranded and besieged inside those buildings. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces are still continuously opening their gunfire towards the people and towards the buildings of the Al-Shifa medical complex, while the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa medical complex were also hit relentlessly by the Israeli occupation forces. Several Israeli airstrikes and artillery shelling targeted those areas.
Another Palestinian journalist has been killed in an Israeli airstrike on the besieged Gaza Strip. The journalist, identified as Saher Akram Rayan, was killed along with his son in an area west of Gaza City. He had been working for the Palestinian News Information Agency for more than 20 years. Nearly 140 journalists have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, which began on December 7th. Last year. Palestinians say the Israeli regime deliberately targets journalists to cover up the truth about the ongoing onslaught on Gaza. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who is in Jordan, says there is growing international consensus that Israel must stop its war on the Gaza Strip.
And nothing justifies the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. The effective delivery of humanitarian aid requires the immediate delivery of a humanitarian ceasefire. The need is urgent. I was at the Rafah border crossing this weekend, and I met with injured Palestinian civilians and directly from our frontline humanitarian colleagues. They are veterans of some of the worst humanitarian crises in recent decades. They have seen it all. And yet, without exception, they told me they had never seen anything as horrible as what is happening in Gaza today. The scale and speed of the deaths and destruction are on an entirely different level. And now starvation is bearing down on Palestinians in Gaza. There is a growing consciousness around the world that all of these must stop.
A new study shows 99% of Israel's arms imports are from U.S., Germany, and despite international calls to ban weapons sales to the regime. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute has reported that 69% of Israel's weapons imports are from the U.S., 30% of the regime's arms purchases also come from Germany. According to the study, the U.S. rapidly delivered thousands of guided bombs and missiles to Israel at the end of 2023. That despite calls for an arms embargo on the regime due to the ongoing onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Israel relies heavily on Western countries for many of the components in its warplanes, helicopters, warships, and submarines. The United Kingdom, Canada, and the Netherlands also provide Israel with critical aircraft components. We also have some breaking news coming in. As you can see on the screen, the health ministry in Gaza says Israeli attacks have so far killed 32,333 and it has injured 74,694, the exact numbers. Well, we were talking about the arms sales to Israel, and we have Mohammed Khalid from the South Africa ANC who is joining us live right now to discuss that further. Sir, tell us, what is your take on this new report? First of all, were you shocked to hear these numbers, or was it something that you expected?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm most certainly not shocked in the least to hear about these particular numbers, because the West, the United Kingdom, and the United States of America have always been conflicted. They've been actively conflicted in the genocide against the Palestinian people. So one is not surprised. It is out there. It is public knowledge. Hence, when we hold Israel accountable, we also hold the West accountable, the US and the UK in particular.
What do you think can be done in order to at least put an arms embargo on Israel? It has proven that it is not using arms. The least to expect is complying with the Geneva Conventions.
Most certainly. Look, the United Nations needs to be lobbied. We need to have a United Nations Security Council resolution basically resolving that there's an arms embargo on the apartheid genocidal state of Israel. Also, pressure needs to be placed, particularly in the UK. We know in the UK there's an elections that are coming up as well. And the political atmosphere is very, very tense and open with possibilities in the UK. We already saw that there's a ceasefire that British Parliament did agree to because of pressure. So pressure needs to be applied by activists, by members of parliament as well, for an arms embargo against the apartheid state of Israel by the UK government. No matter what you try in the US, that will not happen. We, as the progressive world, need to increasingly isolate the United States of America. That's what needs to happen.
And do you think that the road to achieving that goal is clear, or how many obstacles do we have to overcome? Considering the growing anti-Israeli sentiment and with the international community becoming more aware?
I think now, compared to before, the road is not as difficult compared to before. The road will be difficult. The Americans and the British and others will impose economic sanctions, or they will attempt to impose economic sanctions on countries who are making these calls. They'll make life very, very difficult. But compared to before, the atmosphere, as you have pointed out to, is much more susceptible to achieving that particular goal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khaled.
Thank you very much.
Muhammad Khaled Sayed from South Africa, ANC. Moving on, Israeli occupation forces have raided the old town of Nablus in the occupied West Bank, injuring several Palestinians. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, joined us earlier with the details.
The Israeli forces had stormed the old town of Nablus, and as you have mentioned, exchange of fire have taken place between the Palestinians in the old town of Nablus and Israeli forces that stormed the area. Israeli troops, as usual, they opened fire at the Palestinians and they wounded at least three Palestinians, according to the Palestinian Red Crescent. The Palestinian fighters succeeded to detonate explosive devices at the Israeli forces' vehicles that were invading Nablus. Elsewhere in Nablus as well, this time the Israeli forces had wounded at least one Palestinian in the village of Beit Horik in Nablus. This happened all after midnight, where Palestinians took to the streets in order to support their brothers and sisters in the Gaza Strip. And the Israeli forces opened fire at the protesters, wounding at least one Palestinian, and they have prevented the vehicle to move this Palestinian who was wounded to one of the hospitals near Beit Horik. Speaking about Tul Karim, at least one more Palestinian was shot and wounded. This time, 15-year-old Palestinian was wounded.
Calls for an end to the genocide in Gaza have once again rung out in a number of cities around the world. People in the Jordanian capital have hit the streets to voice their support for Palestinians. More than 2,000 demonstrators gathered near the Israeli embassy in Amman to condemn the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. But Jordanian police clamped down on the rally, firing tear gas at the protesters and detaining some of them. There were fresh pro-Palestinian rallies in several Iranian cities as well. Protesters in the capital, Tehran, gathered in front of the British embassy to vent their anger at the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. Calling out Western double standards, shocked at the complete indifference of Western countries, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., the demonstrators couldn't even wait till the next day. Recent appalling media reports of the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza once again brought pro-Palestine demonstrators together, this time outside the British Embassy in Tehran, to condemn Israel's egregious atrocities, particularly in Al-Shifa Hospital, with full support from countries that have always claimed to be advocates of human rights, but now blatantly compromising it in favor of their political discretion.
We have been watching the Zionists' atrocities for the past 6 months as they enjoy full support from the US and the UK. We are in front of the British Embassy now, and the Ukrainian flag is completely visible from here after 2 years. And they have lost only 5,000 civilians so far in the war, but in Gaza the toll is over 32,000. What happened to the human rights slogan?
Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City remains under siege since last week when the occupying regime raided the healthcare facility with reports of women being subjected to torture and rape.
Coming here is the least we can do for our brothers and sisters in Gaza. I hope the international community takes action to stop the genocide in Gaza. The Zionists have absolutely no respect for international law. There must be a way to stop this. They don't even care about the ICJ ruling that requires them to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza.
The demonstrators denounced the U.S. and the U.K.'s shameful silence in the face of Israel's total disregard for the February 26th ICJ ruling demanding humanitarian aid to be allowed into Gaza and for the genocide to stop.
I have run out of patience. That's why I'm here. I hope that we can get our voices heard. So far, all I have been able to do to help the women and children in Gaza was calling for support with social media hashtags. Clearly, that is not enough.
More demonstrations are expected to take place, particularly in Tehran's Palestine Square, where Iranians have been holding numerous pro-Palestine rallies since Israel launched its brutal genocidal war on Gaza. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Russia is still reeling from Friday's terrorist attack in a concert hall near the capital, Moscow, that left scores of people dead and scores more wounded. Four main suspects have been charged with acts of terrorism and may face life in prison. A court statement said two of the detainees have already pleaded guilty. One of them, according to the Russian media, said he is a citizen of Tajikistan. All have been remanded at pre-trial custody until May 22nd. Authorities arrested the men, all of them, as they were attempting to escape to Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin has pledged to bring the perpetrators to justice. Earlier, Kiev rejected the notion that it was involved in the incident that took place at a crowded Kharkiv city hall. The attackers also set the venue ablaze, and that caused the roof of the hall to collapse. Russian authorities have confirmed 137 deaths and more than 180 injuries as a result of the attack. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Goodbye.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Happy Iranian New Year!
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. We read in another part of the Holy Dua of Abu Hamza, O God, bestow mercy on me. We ask God to show mercy on us and bestow your blessings on me when they put me on the ground, washing my body, and when my dear ones and relatives turn me over to different sides. We ask Allah, the Exalted, to bestow His mercy and blessings on us when our body is being washed after death. At that moment, we are involuntarily in the hands of those who perform ghusl. This will happen to each and every one of us. None of us will escape that moment. It will happen to all of us, and therefore you should think about it. And show kindness to me when my people carry my corpse into the grave. They carry us, hold us on their shoulders, and take us to our eternal home. And be generous towards me when I am alone in my grave, entering upon you. They will bury us in a grave. This is a reminder. So, we should not ignore these moments, and they should always be in front of our eyes. This is one of the reasons why we are advised to visit graveyards and the dead.
دنیای اسلام یک
نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some people do not like it when they are reminded of death. They should not dislike it because this is a cure and medicine. It is a cure for our selfishness, our ignorance, and our lust. We read in another part of the holy dua of Abu Hamza, O God, bestow your mercy on me when I have no answer to give, when I cannot find my tongue to give you answers, and when my mind makes a mistake when you ask me a question. When we are short of answers before divine questions, we should know that divine questions are not like the ones that are asked in this world. In this world, we can maneuver the other side by using his own folly, ignorance, and emotions, but there, everything is clear to the being who questions us. Therefore, we should think about that moment.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
As an expansive land with diverse climate, Iran is blessed with numerous natural attractions. This time, I'm going to visit the largest island in the Persian Gulf, an island which is larger than 65 countries in the world. Hi, I'm Javad Gharay, an Iran trotter. I believe Iran to be a unique country. On my travels to the most pristine spots in Iran, I will show you the beauties of my beloved country, a country I'm proud of with all my heart. Reshm Island is located a few kilometers off the southern coast of Iran, opposite the Iranian port cities of Bandar Abbas and Bandar Khamir. In terms of ecotourism, Reshm is regarded as the most important island in the Persian Gulf, thanks to its endless geological attractions. Reshm Island Geopark is among the first UNESCO-recognized geoparks around the globe and the first one in the whole Middle East. It was inscribed as a global geopark in 2006 in order to have an understanding of the journey our planet has made over millennia. UNESCO has designated some areas as geoparks. Geoparks have clear borders and contain a number of outstanding geological phenomena. It's expected the geoparks contribute substantially to the economic development of their surrounding communities. In addition to geological phenomena, geoparks usually contain historical and archaeological sites with natural and cultural attractions. My first destination on this journey was a place called Chakavi. The best time to go to this part of Iran is in late winter. Unique folds and geological landforms that characterize Resh mountains and hills are considered among the most beautiful forms of soil erosion in the world. This island's mountains are full of astonishing statue-like formations which mesmerize their viewers. In spite of the intense heat, the first destination in Resh made me feel good. Nothing is more important than health, and now I really appreciate its importance. Actually, I always knew its importance. 9 months ago, an accident happened to me in the Zagros Mountains, and I required surgery on my knee and had to do constant physiotherapy and long hours of exercise. I had very hard times. Now, after that long period of recovery, I'm on a new journey, and where is better than the Chakavi Valley in Resh Mailit? This is unique.
It is noon and I am in the Chakavi Valley in Resh Mailit. The temperature is now 26 degrees on the Celsius scale. Right now, the Gandab Defile in the heights of the Zagros Mountains in Charmahal and Bakhtiari province is buried under heavy snow with a temperature of about 25 degrees below zero on the Celsius scale. In other words, there is an about 50-degree temperature difference between the two points in Iran. It's not insignificant. In fact, it is a blessing. I love such temperature differences. I love such diversities. I love the country's climate diversity, natural diversity, and ethnic diversity. How can you not love a country such as Iran, given all this diversity and beauty? By the way, the heat is getting unbearable in the middle of winter. The soil is not solid at all and falls away easily. If you don't watch your step, you might fall down to the valley floor. Oh my God, how beautiful this scene is. Look what the hands of nature have done to this mountain and this valley. Being like wax in the hands of nature, they have turned into whatever nature has wished. It is a very ideal place for taking photos, even at night.
Here is a very beautiful spot, but at the same time really dangerous because what looks like a solid rock is in fact clay. These astonishing figure-like formations you see in the Chakavi Valley are a result of water erosion. Since Geshem Island and Hormuzgan province in general are close to the equator, the rains here are really torrential, and when it rains here, the whole valley might be covered with flood water within just half an hour. Such flood water may leave nothing intact in the valley. It would erode the valley, carving eccentric shapes here and there. It might be fatal if you happen to be in the valley when it begins to rain. The trail is really beautiful and it is really exciting, but it is a bit dangerous because I first thought it to be a rock, but it is not a rock. It is in fact compressed soil, which is fragile and therefore could be very dangerous when you are walking on it. It's very fragile indeed. This is fantastic. The path is extraordinary. I love this place very much. Here is filled with excitement. The area makes you feel good because it is almost in pristine condition. It is wonderful. The coral and rocky beaches of Geshem Island are regarded as the most beautiful beaches of Iran and the Persian Gulf. In some of these spots with crystal clear water, sea vegetation and animals have created astonishing scenes for tourists and scuba divers. But one of the main reasons behind the attractiveness of these beaches is that, fortunately, you cannot see even a single construction site here. In fact, the pristine condition of these beaches is regarded as their main attracting factor. On my way, I came across a beautiful spot around Geshem Dam, spotted with green trees and water, making a stunning scene and a proper place for birds to live in. Delimiting reservation areas for tourism under the name of geoparks has been at play across the world since the year 2000. So far, over 80 geoparks have been inscribed on the UNESCO list. Currently, China is the leading Asian country with the most geoparks in the world. It means tourism, with the emphasis on nature reservation, is very important for Beijing.
جزیره قشم یکی از جزیره‌های بسیار خشک خلیج فارس ایران عزیزمونه.
قشم is a very dry island in the Persian Gulf, and if you explore the island carefully, you will see hundreds of small dams and ponds. The ponds like this you see owe their water to rain. A one-hour rainfall is enough to fill this pond with water. The locals can use this water, which is fresh, for consumption. One reason for making ponds here is to make a good place for some birds, mammals, and plants. Nature explorers who love bird watching are recommended to come here to watch and even snap pictures of different migratory or native birds. With good rainfalls, these ponds could have incredible scenes to offer. Although the best reason to visit Qeshm is winter, the heat is getting unbearable at noon, even at this time of year. Before I become heat stroke, I could find somewhere to take refuge in, a place in the shade or in the valley floor. The heat is sweltering. I changed my direction a little bit to visit one of the most amazing attractions in Qeshm Island. My next destination was a unique valley called Chah Ku. The valley is regarded as part of Qeshm Geopark. It is in fact one of the main geo sites in the island. But the significance and attractions of this island is not confined to its geo sites or its local culture and traditions. Up to a few years ago, the island's wildlife was going to suffer widespread destruction, but thanks to a good education given by some environmental NGOs, the locals had a good performance in relation to the preservation of the island's flora and fauna. In principle, the locals enjoy rich culture, and in Qeshm you cannot see a person abusing animals. This has blessed the island with a rich, abundant wildlife. In addition to mammals, reptiles, and amphibians, 239 species of birds have been identified so far in the island, making it a unique paradise for nature explorers and bird watchers. Therefore, before I got to the Chah Ku Valley, I stopped by to watch the birds in one of the ponds near the village of Eastern Chah Ku, located near the Chah Ku geosite. Look how many birds there are there. I am 2 kilometers away from the Chah Ku Valley, and the scene behind me is in fact the water behind Chah Ku Dam. The village of Eastern Chah Ku is about 200 meters from the dam, and the water here is very vital for the villagers. But it is also vital for the ecosystem here. I mean, the wildlife, migratory birds and plants. I cannot identify the birds from here. I'd better move forward to have a better look at them with the help of the binoculars. I may find out what bird family they belong to. Generally speaking, geoparks bring about prosperity to the areas they are located in by attracting tourists in large numbers. They also contribute to the preservation of local culture and architecture. As usual, I spent the night on one of the local tourist guest houses in the village of Eastern Chah Ku and enjoyed the local dishes to contribute to the prosperity of Qeshm Geopark. By staying there, I also had the chance to watch for hours foxes indigenous to the island.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam. Is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. During the season of spring, all the nature, including the trees, glorify Allah. All the creatures of Allah, in a way, are worshipping Him. So why some people burn the trees or tease the animals? Therefore, during springtime and especially during the New Year celebrations, we must be careful about our nature around. We must not trespass in the gardens or orchards of the people if we want to enjoy the nature. Our enjoyment as a Muslim must be based on Islamic rulings. In the Holy Quran, one of the attributes of oppressors is ruining the crop and the stock. We are Muslims and we must respect our environment. Even we cannot make the pure drinking water dirty. Even doing ghusl or ritual ablution in a water which is clean and for drinking is an unfavorable act according to the religion of Islam. Islam is a religion for life, and all the dimensions of life must be taken into account for its believers. ¶¶ Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qarati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Michael Gove, the UK's Secretary of State for Levelling Up, announced the government's redefinition of extremism, we'll be examining the implications of his statement in this week's show. It seems Mr. Gove is attempting to invoke the divide-and-rule tactics of the former British Empire to weaken the pro-Palestine movement that's been sweeping the country since October the 7th, as Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
The British government has been grappling with the question of extremism for years now. It has failed even to define extremism in any clear fashion, and has been struggling to fight back against an avalanche of criticism that its counter-extremism policies are Islamophobic. The genocide in Gaza has focused minds in the British elite because of the massive sympathy for the Palestinians visible on the streets. The desperate attempt to cast pro-Palestine protesters as genocidal is a desperate attempt to split the movement. The government is trying to reframe extremism in such a way that more radical supporters of Palestinian liberation are demonized, criminalized, and disavowed by the rest of the movement. The minister leading this is the toxic Michael Gove, the most pro-Zionist minister in the government. He has a history of involvement with Zionist lobby groups and, for example, was the first chairman of the neoconservative and Islamophobic think tank Policy Exchange. It's no coincidence that the new policy he is introducing was dreamt up by the Policy Exchange in a paper published in 2022. All of its main proposals were adopted by Lord William Shawcross in his review of Prevent, published in 2023. Shawcross is famously Islamophobic and was appointed as a senior fellow at the Policy Exchange in 2018, prior to being appointed to the Prevent review in 2021. Shawcross's recommendations were all accepted by the government, and thus the new policy has effectively been written by a leading Islamophobic think tank. Among the innovations are a new blacklisting agency in Gove's department and a change in the status of the Commission for Countering Extremism, which changes from being an advisory to an enforcement agency. But behind Policy Exchange are a shadowy group of foundations which provide cash for its work. Though they are secretive, we can reveal at least two. The first and most significant is the Charles Wolfson Charitable Trust, which donates almost every year and has given Policy Exchange more than £3 million between 2007 and 2022. The Wolfson family, which runs the trust, are the owners of the next retail chain. The Wolfson family also funds Beit Lochem, which channels money to the occupation forces, and the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in promoting illegal settlements in occupied East Jerusalem. Another source of funds is the Rosencrantz Foundation, which has given to the think tank for more than a decade, along with other Islamophobic causes. Its director, Robert Rosencrantz, was appointed a director of Policy Exchange in 2010. In other words, British government policy on extremism is captured by Policy Exchange, and Policy Exchange is in part a front for Zionist interests.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is Dr. Eytal Hajj. Dr. Leila is the director and senior caseworker at PreventWatch, which is a community-led initiative that supports individuals affected by the Prevent programme. She's written extensively on Prevent and co-authored the People's Review of Prevent, which was an alternative to the widely boycotted official review of the Prevent policy. Welcome to the show. David, the Policy Exchange, they must be absolutely delighted, wouldn't they, with Michael Gove's statement. I mean, could have been written by them. I mean, what do you make of that think tank?
Well, I mean, more or less was written by them. I mean, Policy Exchange is the first think tank that I think I ever looked at back in the late noughties. And we looked at the way in which it was encouraging Islamophobia, and that was why we'd looked at it. And we discovered, one of the things we discovered was that amongst the people who funded it were these foundations, and the foundations were all named after individuals, and we tried to work out what they were, and it transpired that, you know, amongst the other things that they funded were these Israeli occupation forces, settlements in the West Bank, and we realised that what we were dealing with here was Zionist foundations. So yeah. It was Zionist foundations who were largely funding the Policy Exchange and other neocon think tanks, and that's what we have here. We have effectively Zionist interests using a think tank to talk to government, and then their views are then taken on by government by people who are appointed by government who come from the think tank itself. Yeah. And then those views themselves are passed on to the minister who himself was a first chair of Policy Exchange. It's a completely self-referential and closed circle.
Mm, I do. Well, Dr. Leila, I mean, what's your view then of the 2022 Policy Exchange report?
So that report was called Delegitimizing Counterterrorism, and it essentially attacked every single Muslim organization or individual who had A, boycotted the Shawcross Review of Prevent, and B, who had signed up and endorsed and supported the People's Review of Prevent. It was essentially a way to divide the Muslim organisations from the non-Muslim organisations and individuals, because if you look at who boycotted the Shawcross report, it extended way beyond any of the Muslim organisations that had been highlighted in that report. But it also tried to then divide Muslim organisations against one another as well, because following that report, there was a tabloid splash of like four organisations that, you know, are seen as the main Islamist agitators. So it kind of further then subdivided some organisations from the main list. Sure. It didn't look at any of the non-Muslim organisations. It didn't look at the fact that the People's Review of Prevent had the foreword from the UN Special Rapporteur for protecting freedoms while countering terrorism. It didn't look at the fact that Professor Conor Gearty had written the second foreword. It didn't look at any of the NGOs, the mainstream NGOs, Amnesty's, the Runnymedes, who had also supported that report. So I think it was just a way to plagiarise the People's Review of Prevent, because 90% of that report from Policy Exchange just spoke about our report without actually tackling any of the issues, whilst just trying to smear these organisations. And the former Prime Minister, David Cameron, wrote a foreword to the Policy Exchange report saying that these people who are basically raising concerns about Prevent are enablers of terrorism. Mm.
Well, of course, Lord Shawcross, David, was in charge of the Charity Commission, wasn't he? I mean, you say a word or two, will you, about his role there, will you?
So he was appointed to the Charity Commission, and he appointed a number of other people to the Charity Commission who were, like him, Islamophobes and had connections to Islamophobic organisations. And his role at the Charity Commission was to take on Muslim charities and to investigate them. Now, quite often, those Muslim charities were investigated after allegations were made about those charities, which had emanated from Israel, you know, unsurprisingly. And so you had an attack on a whole series of Muslim charities, actually, and, of course, virtually no Zionist charities, for example, were targeted. And what it's meant is that the whole Muslim charity sector lives in fear of the Charity Commission. And to try and be in a charity and be a Muslim and to have a Muslim charity is really very difficult now because of this British state onslaught on the Muslim charity sector. And, of course, then Shawcross goes on after that to be appointed to the Policy Exchange and then to be appointed by government to do the review of Prevent. So he's, you know, he's not in a position to do any significant serious review because, of course, he is party free. He's all fundamentally conflicted.
Mm. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction there, Dr. Layla, I mean, you were part of that, you know, people's review of Prevent, which actually engaged, didn't it, in debate with the review of extremism that was conducted by Lord Shawcross. Just tell us a little bit, really, about what you found during that process.
Yeah, so the People's Review of Prevent was set up as an alternative to the Shawcross Review because once he was appointed and boycotted, we knew he wasn't going to take on any of the real issues and concerns that had been raised for well over a decade, nor was he going to look at people who had actually been impacted, referred to Prevent, etc. So the People's Review of Prevent took into consideration almost 600 cases of people who had actually been referred to Prevent, as well as all of the academic research that had come out previously on Prevent. And at the end of that, our three main conclusions was that Prevent doesn't actually work. It's not fit for purpose. It doesn't prevent terrorism. There's been zero evidence to suggest that. And in fact, all the evidence suggests that it actively doesn't work, especially when you look at convicted terrorists who have been known to prevent prior. You know, they weren't caught by Prevent to stop and therefore prevent terrorism. The second main conclusion was that it causes harm, particularly to Muslim families and children, traumatizing them. And the third main conclusion was that it is curtailing so many human rights, from freedom of expression to data privacy and data rights. So those were the three main conclusions, and none of those conclusions were picked up by government or engaged with at any point, not that we expected them to be, other than that policy exchange report that was then subsequently published about a month or so after.
Mm. David, we've mentioned the Wolfson family on this show on a number of previous occasions, haven't we? And I see that they are implicated in this process too, aren't they? So I wonder whether you could just outline what exactly then is their involvement in this particular issue.
So the Wilson family have been making money in this country for decades and decades through the Great Universal Stores and now most recently through Next PLC. And they've made a reputation for philanthropy. So they have a number of different foundations associated with the family. There are four or five different foundations. They give large sums of money to Wilson College, Oxford, or Wilson College, Cambridge, and many other charitable donations. But of course, also, they give significant sums of money to Zionist projects, so to settlements in the West Bank, and particularly they fund the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in illegal activities in East Jerusalem. And they also fund, and indeed, the chair of this charity, Beit Halochim, is an organisation which gives money directly to the Israel occupation forces. Mm-hmm. So there's a real sense there in which they're involved directly in supporting the Zionist project and the genocide in Gaza. But also, of course, they're involved in supporting Islamophobic activities through the policy exchange. And Andrew Wilson, for example, or Simon Wilson are involved with that. And as a result, what you have is that you can see that the Zionists are actually core to developing and pushing Islamophobic ideas in the UK and in other countries too. And that's a thing I've been seeing for many years now. It's one of the things which attracted attention to my views when I was at the University of Bristol. But it's very clear that there's a connection between the Zionists and the pushing of Islamophobia, and you can see it through this particular connection between the Wilson family and the cash they give to the policy exchange.
Mm. Michael Gove was the first chair, wasn't he, of the policy exchange? And as I was saying to David earlier, I mean, this report or this statement could have been written by them. I mean, what's your thoughts on that briefly before we go to our next report?
I mean, Michael Gove has been problematic for many reasons, not just the policy exchange link. I mean, he was at the centre of the Trojan Horse affair, effectively ruining education in the UK. Yeah. And many other Islamophobic as well as anti-Palestinian sentiments have come from him. But I mean, his involvement in this, as well as Policy Exchange's involvement in the new so-called definition of extremism, is to be expected. Yeah. I don't think we can imagine anyone else who would have taken the reins on this, nor anybody who wanted to. I mean, the Independent Review of Terrorism doesn't have Prevent under his purview, nor extremism. Sure. You know, Sarah Khan, when she was appointed as head of CCE, everyone thought she was going to come out with a definition of extremism, and she didn't. Mm. Robin Simcox, who then took over CCE, didn't.
So it's significant then that it's Michael Gove. But it's important, I think, that we shine a light on his role, and you know, I think that will undermine his credibility still further, hopefully. But we'll just take a pause there now to our next report about the naked abuse of parliamentary privilege.